Blog Talk Radio.
Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis, Chuck Thurston, and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys.
Hey,
good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Paula. Hi, guys.
Hey, we're all here. Yay. Marvin was here last week, but he was
sort of
doing
hot
very
halfway.
Well. You sound much better, Marvin, so yay.
Oh, I am.
Good.
Yeah, I'm
good.
Probably 95% past my cough cold. Last week I was in the middle of it.
Yeah. Well, that's never any fun.
I missed you guys because we were up visiting with family for the couple of weeks before that over the holiday, and then I was not in good health, so... But it's wonderful to be back with all three of you. I love
you
guys.
You too. Oh, I love you too.
Good to be back with you too.
Yeah. We are having fun doing this study on marriage and family life, paper 84 from the Urantia book. And, oh, my gosh, what a great paper this is. You know, every time I thoroughly enjoy studying with the three of you, just so much. Gosh, I can't even tell you how much. I look forward to it every Saturday. And, you know, a lot of folks listen to the archive, and we get feedback from time to time from people. It's like, oh, wow, you listen. That's awesome, you know. So that's really gratifying to know. We have our regulars who come on the board with us every week, and I always love to see you guys on the board, Perry and Isadora, and Robert hasn't showed up yet, but we have Sally on with us today. And then, of course, we have our callers, Vaughn and Arvilla, who always call and listen. It's just so great to have the crew here. And I invite you, dear friends, if you're on the board or if you're listening, that if you want to make a comment, just press the one key and your hand will go up. First, you have to call, though, 646-716-8158. And then once you're on, just press the one key and your hand will raise and we'll know you want to be on the show, want to make a comment. and we appreciate it. We love hearing from you, too. But we also love talking about this stuff ourselves. So, you know, we're not, it's like me, we're not at a shortage for things to say about this amazing book and its wonderful teachings. Were you going to say something, Marvin?
Yeah. I think one of the things that those of us who've participated in study groups for decades really have learned to appreciate is how very different minds, and it's not just minds, it's temperaments and whole personalities, kind of react and approach the material. And I agree with you, Paul. I think this particular little foursome we've had going for a while is really an interesting, I mean, each of us is so different in the way we approach the material and kind of how we think and how we process that it makes the reaction to the revelation very, very interesting in the interaction we have. So it's really, I look forward to it as well. It's really kind of fun. And it's one of the gifts, I think, of being family together, spiritual family, is how different we are as we react to this stimulus of revelation. It's really neat.
Yeah, I have some definite thoughts about how we are spiritual family more than we know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you read this book, it has its way with you. And I never cease to be astonished as I read it and reread it, how much it has permeated my being, and how much I think in terms of this construct. And you read it and you feel like, yeah, I always knew that humankind is one vast family. This world, our home, you know, just like that great poem from Vern Grimsley. And I think we all read it and we come away, you know, if you didn't believe that, you wouldn't find anything in this book, I don't think. If you didn't already believe that God loves us all and that we are on, you know, and I mean believe on some level in your core, that, you know, the Heavenly Father isn't playing favorites, and that He loves us all, and that we are family. You probably wouldn't read the Urantia book. I've always marveled at what I've learned about readers over many years of serving the movement. We're all, for the most part, Urantia book readers are engaged in service activities for a living. Traditional services like teaching or therapy or, you know, social work. And not, you know, not high income activity. Just, you know, who we are. And I always wonder, you know, are Urantia book readers service oriented because they read the Urantia book, or did they read the Urantia book because they're service oriented? Were they attracted to it because they're so service-oriented to begin with? And I think maybe it's a bit of both.
Yeah, it's probably a bit of both.
Chicken and egg problem.
Yeah. Chicken and egg problem. We tend to be very altruistic, though.
One of the things that kind of, when Derek started doing those Spirit of Truth interviews with long-time readers,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's got quite a few of them now, I think all three of you probably submitted to that particular ritual.
Submitted to it.
But anyway, one of the things that really impressed me as I began to see these, like, sort of accumulate, is how different everyone is. I mean, it's like, okay, we're starting with your answer book, you know, and it's sort of what the point of that was, or is, continues to be, it's, you know, to look at how people carry that into service in the world. But it's such a variety. Nobody does it the same way. You know, because it's rooted in your authentic personality, I think, is part of the reason why that's the case. There's a uniqueness, you know, like, the, you know, we have the adjuster, we have our personality. There's this blending of uniqueness with, in a sense, sameness of spirit. but that leads to a unique path for each person. And it's so interesting to see, particularly on this world, how that can unfold and go in all kinds of different directions and, you know, different inspirations for service that each one of us has leads to manifestations that are completely different from everyone else. But I really, that's something about your answer that I've always noticed and really valued, is that it supports the uniqueness of the individual in their own discoveries. It doesn't, like, say, everybody believes this and then we're done. It's more like it creates a frame for understanding within which you can grow and develop in this ever-expanding kind of way, you know, which is true to the nature of God within us, which always has infinite, unrevealed potential.
It's to me, it's fascinating. As kind of my background, you were talking about our service, our different service professions. My background has always been in the social sciences and in particular psychology, but also sociology. In fact, you know, social psychology is a field unto itself. It's a hybrid of sociology and psychology. It's how human beings function as individuals and how human beings function as a collective, as it really, my best understanding is how we function in culture. Culture being the common frame of reference that a group of people share. And one of the things that's so amazing to me about the Oranje book and the view of human nature that it presents to us, and I'm astonished at this, you know, is it puts forward a vision of the cosmos where there are literally trillions of inhabited worlds and billions of personalities, persons on each one of those worlds. And each of the four of us, for instance, is a person, you know, created by the originating personality, the Universal Father. And we share in common that we are persons. And we have certain qualities that they lay out as to what a person or a personality portrays and how we function. And yet no one, you know, and put aside our physical appearance, right, if we couldn't see each other, but if we heard each other like we do here on the program, we express, right? No one would mistake me for you, Paula, or me for you, Chuck, or Andre, right? We each are so distinct in how we respond to reality. And I'm always impressed by this when we get in a Zoom environment, and I'm looking at like 25 or 30 of these folks, and each one of them is a personality. We have that in common, but each is so utterly unique that no one would mistake one for the other, having any interaction with them, and that unique is replicated through countless trillions upon trillions of personalities. Each one could not be mistaken for another one. That's how unique we are. And you put that uniqueness side by side with the fact that we participate in cultural frames of reference, right? Like, we are part of this Urantia movement, right? And I ask myself the question, how different would I be if I had never encountered the Urantia book and weren't part of this culture for most of my life, you know? How
I ask
different
myself would, that, too.
Yeah. How different would be the activities I was engaged in, the priorities I was involved in, the relationships I had, the histories, the shared histories I've had? It would be dramatically different. And so we are part of a culture that is steeped in a new epical revelation as it is being inaugurated in our world's history. And we are agendaughters on top of that. And we're participants in a world culture that is the nativity sphere of 10 million worlds in this inhabited universe. It's a kind of a cohort culture that we share some remarkably unique things together. So while we are so individual, yet we have these things in common that have shaped us, that are very, very powerful and profound for each of us because of our immersion in this particular revelation at this point in history. It's really thick stuff, you know. There's so much that goes into it.
I know.
It's just,
it changes.
I'm struck by that.
Yeah, me too. I wonder, you know, I'd like to ask you guys a question based on, you know, we're about halfway, well, maybe halfway, almost halfway through the study of this paper. What in your, you know, because Andre and I opened last week, we were talking about, you know, how many of us have picked the wrong partner the first time, you know, and try to get it right the second time. You know, God bless us. We never give up. And thank God for that, because, you know, if you do find the right partner, it's really so gratifying and so amazing. And what in your mind, and I know you guys have thought about it, what does the ideal family life look like? What's the ideal family look like?
It's a great
That's
great,
not a loaded
question.
Oh, well,
you
know,
know
it's
all...
Go ahead, Marvin.
I'll be brief because I've already spoken a little too much.
Well, you've done so much helping families get along, so yeah.
Kind of as a family therapist. And having worked with really hundreds of couples over 40, 45, 50 years, because I did a lot of couple work as well and family work, and having had the personal experience of just the good fortune of finding a mate in my early 20s, that it turned out we were well matched and we've kind of gone the distance through thick and thin with each other and remain very committed to that initial marriage. What I would say is critical to the health of good marriage and good family is a deep commitment to spiritual values and to living the spiritual life and to a spiritual practice. And when two people have that, they can go through almost anything, I think, find their way toward commonality. But, you know, obviously that's just one point of view. There are other factors as well. So I'll just share that. And I'm interested in you guys' reactions as well.
Any other thoughts, Chuck or Andre?
Well, I don't even know how to touch that. It's sort of, for me, it comes in the realm of I know it when I see it. I won't make the comparison there, but
I know it when
it's one
I
of those things
it.
That I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it. Clearly, it's dominated by love. You can say a lot of different things. It's dominated by common regard, mutual regard for the partners. Love for the kids, balanced. You know, that balance is really important. The idea of how important it is that the love for the partners doesn't overshadow the love for the kids, and at the same time that the love for the kids doesn't overshadow the love for the partners.
I think that's really important.
And that's a tough one for a lot of people to get right, but
it is.
To me, it seems that that's one of the most important aspects of it, and just constant mutual respect. And I always like, you know, in relationships, I think it's really important to understand that love does not necessarily imply all the other things working. So that I think that the biggest conflation that people have with love is trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I have learned in my life that love and trust are two separate domains. You can love someone and the trust may really not be there. And you can trust someone and the love may not really be there. And the other combinations, of course, you know, but when both are in tandem, if both are there, that's what really makes a really good working relationship. And probably to start out with, trust is more important in some ways than love. Think about in the ancient days, how many arranged marriages were really based on nothing but an agreement, trust, and moving forward that way, and the love mm-hmm. evolving after that. So,
yeah, there's a trust that love will evolve.
It's an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just want to throw in one thing because Diane said it on the board, and I think it's important, and it is, you're right, love and trust, but she also mentioned respect. And I think in many ways, respect is a huge part of love. It's hard to have a deep affection for somebody you can't respect. You know what I mean? And so, you know, and then what does respect mean? You know, mutual respect. But go ahead, Chuck. You were going to say something.
Oh, I just wanted to bring up this one paragraph. I think we probably read it last week. But I'll read it, and then I can sort of explain why I think it's, I mean, in my own case, why how it was helpful. This is in later in the paragraph. We were laughing about this week. Last week, it's kind of a spoiler. But this is a comment about the family council practice. This is in same paper we're in, but in a later section, section 7, paragraph 29, where they say that human society would be greatly improved if the civilized races would more generally return to the family council practices of the Andites. They did not maintain the patriarchal or autocratic form of family government. They were very brotherly and associative, brotherly and sisterly, of course, and associative. Interesting they make a distinction there. Freely and frankly discussing every proposal and regulation of a family nature. They were ideally fraternal in all their family government. And they're ideally fraternal in all their family government. And now this is the real kicker. In an ideal family, filial and parental affection are augmented by fraternal devotion. So
that's a great quote to bring up right now. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, Claire and I were both Jewish book readers, and we were aware of this passage and talked about it and wanted to implement that in our family life. I mean, we really made a deliberate attempt to do that. And, you know, we'd have family meetings, and the kids would all sit around, and they were, like, really little. And then, you know, I don't know, it just created a good feeling in the home and the family that, like, everybody's involved. But particularly,
and everybody's
idea,
voice matters.
Everybody's voice matters, right? Nobody was lording it over anybody else. But particularly this notion of fraternal affection being augmented by fraternal. In other words, even though you're the parent of your kids, you're also their, you know, brother or sister as well in God's family. So that really struck me when I first read that, and I thought about it a lot and continue to, that part of being a parent is also being a good sibling, even to your own children, in this larger sense that they're talking about.
Just like
so
Jesus, a father, brother,
that's me,
a mother,
you read about
that, brother.
Right, Jesus. Right, exactly. Yeah, how Jesus raised his younger siblings after the loss of his father. This is a perfect demonstration of that, in a way, which I'm sure will greatly benefit this planet as time goes on. I mean, we're missing the ideal example we would have had from an Adam and Eve, from material son and daughter. They would have set the standard, an exciting standard that everyone would want to reach themselves of the, you know, the quality of what's possible in family life. And it would have been right there. You know, we could see it. We could learn from them and see what it looks like, see what it feels like. And we're missing that, unfortunately, which is a huge loss. I mean, there's the loss of the, you know, the upstep, the genetic upstep that they would have provided. But there's also the loss of their this kind of social standard that they would have established. And, you know, they're both important, but I think as we all struggle to have decent marriages and sound families, the lack, you know, that missing piece of a living demonstration in our midst, you know, that means we're on our own again. You know, we're back to the DIY thing. So we do our best. And not always with complete success, but still, to the spirit, to the desire to make it be good. And if you can keep that alive, then a lot of other things will work out as best they can.
I think the term ideal is relative to the changing mores that we're all living and dealing with, you know. But one thing that I've noticed, in marriages that fall apart, is there becomes, a rift that just, and it's from lack of communication. It's wonderful, actually, when people do seek outside help, because I think it helps them understand each other, and it helps them get through a problem that they couldn't normally get through. But sometimes the gulf is just too big. But one mistake that I see women often make is they expect men to be mothers. They expect men to parent the way they do. And men don't do that. And I viva la difference. You know, children need both. And I've admired so much in my daughter's family that when her husband wants to father his boys, and even if that means being stern and strict, which he can be, she bows out and she lets him be a father to his sons, which is so important, I think. And I know, were he to be abusive, she would, you know, say something or do something, but he's not. He loves his sons. He wants what's best for them. And they're both wonderful kids. And I think it's because, in large part, she lets him be a father. And she appreciates him as a father. And she fully appreciates that fathers are not mothers. And I just wish myself that more of that could happen in marriages, you know. And oftentimes I see women becoming so focused on their children that they completely forget their husband's needs. And that's not good either, you know. But that's just from a feminine point of view. And, you know, obviously fathers make mistakes too. You know, I mean, and what makes a marriage work, I think, is relative to the current situation, whatever we're all going through, is a willingness to listen to everybody's voice, to hear everyone's concerns, to, you know, validate their feelings. I made that terrible mistake as a mother. I invalidated my daughter's feelings. I told her she shouldn't feel that way. Well, that, and it took someone completely outside the family pointing it out to me. She said my daughter was a teenager at the time, and she was going through her teenage hell. And I was going through it too with her, and my friend said, well, tell me just a typical scenario. And so I said, well, she'll say, nobody knows what it feels like to be in my head, you know. And she was essentially saying, I'm hurting inside. And my friend said, well, what do you say? I said, well, you shouldn't feel that way. And when she pointed it out, she said, bingo, that's what you're doing. You're invalidating her feelings. You shouldn't do that. And it just, a light bulb went off. And I thank God for that woman every day of my life, because it made all, that little bit of advice made all the difference. But you have to be willing to talk things over with your friends and other people you respect and get some advice sometimes, because parenting in this world is not an easy thing to do. And, you know, parents need to be kind to each other, and understanding that, hey, we need to get together on this. That's the other one, another mistake I see parents make. They let their children separate them, you know. They don't put on a united front. And, that's a mistake.
Paula, it's interesting. And just hearing you share some of what you shared, and having gone through many of those experiences, and you know, we all of us here, all four of us have children, now adult children, and those relationships continue. You know, so the learning and the growing in family connection, even though it's out of its main generative stage, you know, and with adult children, it's ongoing, these relationships and our learning that goes on within them. But a couple of things sort of struck me. One is, and this sort of falls under the general assumption, that what we learn here in this life about the nature of family relationships and how it serves as a lens to the larger set of family relationships we have with God and with all beings in the universe, you know, as we proceed in our universe adventure and the journey, it's a critical set of exposures to family reality that we experience when we engage in family in this life. But we will experience it, those of us who haven't had it here, will experience it on the early mansion world in a somewhat different context. But they say it's critical for every mortal being to experience those realities early in their universe ascent. And I'm really convinced that we get a crucial but a very small percentage of what we learn about family relationships through these early family exposures, and that we're due to understand these things ongoing more and more as we proceed through the universe in much more sophisticated fashion. And a couple of things that strike me, one is where they say that marriages are not made in heaven, and the marriage relationship is of this world and does not continue in the next life. And so I picked out a couple of paragraphs. One is 83:1-4, where they say in the middle of the paragraph, but while marriages may be approved or disapproved on high, they are hardly made in heaven. And there's another statement in the text where they say most marriages are not made in heaven, which means some have some relevance or some greater import in terms of, you know, the way the celestials look at them, but most marriages do not. But regardless, there's this statement from 38:2, speaking of the angels, they are much as you will be on the mansion worlds, where you will, quote, neither marry nor be given in marriage, but will be as the angels of heaven. For all who shall be accounted worthy to attain the mansion worlds, neither marry nor are given in marriage, neither do they die anymore, for they're equal to the angels. So that's really interesting. And put one more beside that, and that's the passage where a mighty messenger is speaking of his relationship with his or her partner of the human life and saying that they serve for long periods of time separate and away from each other in different assignments, and many times were assigned together to work in partnership, probably because of the unique experience that they had shared in this earth life and all the way along. So working partnerships kind of are reunited marriage relationships at points, that's a possibility. So the overall thought for me is that this experience we have in this life of marriage and family is kind of a not quite unique, because I think we do something similar if we haven't had that experience up on the mansion worlds, but it's an initial exposure that gives us a very deep and intimate immersing in these family realities and introduces us to the nature of our relationship with God as a parent and our relationship to each other as sisters and brothers in a very personal way. But it doesn't survive, that relationship doesn't survive this life, which is really interesting. From the mansion worlds on, we go on and function in the universe not as part of a couple, but as individuals, interestingly enough, in contrast to angels who function as part of a couple all the time, ongoing by their very nature. So that's really interesting, too.
The lesson is we're all family.
Yeah.
We're all one cosmic family, so.
Yeah, Andre.
Sorry,
yeah.
I don't know that it's so much that we, you know, clearly the marital relationship doesn't obtain up there, but the whole training regime of the constellation is confederating people in these family groups in which they have to learn to get along with the Univitatia, you know, for instance. So, I mean, your first seven worlds are going to be with 10 other Univitatia in different family groups on each of those worlds, and those confederated into companies of 10, and then in, I forget what term they use, but those companies in another core of 10. So you're basically being confederated into towns built on these families and learning to get along and functioning as a family group, basically. It's not like you have the option to jump in and out of those groups. And so they're effectively functioning like families. And they're getting us used to the fact that we're going to be, we think marriage is tough. You know, by the time we get to the core of the finality, we will be well-schooled. I mean, by the time we get to Adentia, we'll be well-schooled in how to get along with each other. We'll be able to get along with anybody by then. But the point is that in a finality core, you have made the oath to serve the Trinity. You're put into a core, and you stay into that core for the duration, at least the duration of this, the rest of this universe age, which is trillions upon trillions of years. You know, that's, get used to loyalty.
So it's not that the family idea goes away. It just gets bigger. it gets bigger and more all-encompassing.
Well, there is a distinction, though.
And it's not our choice so much right at the beginning. I think the finality core, probably it is our choice. But go ahead, Marvin, sorry.
Well,
oh, and by the way, before we go on to another topic, we'll want to bring Arvilla on. She's been wanting to weigh in on this subject.
Okay, great.
Yeah, just briefly, though, there is an important distinction between our experience in the constellations and what they say is this initial immersion in family, and that is, that, and they use the term, that it's critical for us to achieve a parental relationship to another, to an immature being, right? Mm-hmm. We're not doing that on the Univitatia experience. We're being fraternal.
No.
Yeah, but what we're not doing anywhere else except a few other places, really, in the universe ascent, where we have the opportunity to be a parent to an immature being and raise them up. That's pretty unique to this experience that we have here. So that's an important sort of carve-out, I think, to what otherwise I think is quite true in what you're saying.
Absolutely, yeah. Totally agree.
Yeah, and I was responding more to the fact of you're talking about the marital relationship. You weren't really alluding when you were talking to the parental relationship. And that's
right.
Very different.
Good point. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
The only other instances are if you come back as a member of the corporeal staff, which I've often thought about, you know, you actually couple with another member of the staff and quote unquote give birth to 1,000 midwayers, and obviously you spend ages on the planet with them co-serving. So think about that as a parenting experience. And the other one is trinitizing, you know, creature trinitization way up close to paradise, where you actually participate in the actual creation of another being kind of from the ground up. Those are the few other places where we function in parental relationship to another being. So otherwise it's here or in the Adamic schools, Adamic families.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, so good points.
Arvilla wants
Let's
to
bring on
make Arvilla. A statement.
Yeah.
Good morning, Arvilla.
Good morning. Oh, this has been a wonderful conversation. We all have been just moved deeply by it. And I love the last one. You just dialogued on that marriage actually is a training for our continual eternal life. And I think that's so true, such a basic thing. But the thought I was had when you were back talking about the different components of marriage, I was blessed that I was given a husband who was a mature person when he was born. And I think he was finalized when he was born. But he had a little state when he lived by, a little motto, that it's about unconditional love. If you don't love your neighbor as much as you love your wife, you don't love your wife enough. And I think I've always liked that little statement, and he lived by that. I mean, he loved the trash man as much as he loved me. He loved his students as much as he loved me.
That was great.
Shit for me in the early part of my marriage. And I said, well, how am I different then? If you love everybody, then how am I different? He says, to you, I have committed my life. To them, I commit my life. It's a matter of having made a commitment to somebody. And another thing that I loved about that, I called it two big C's. One was commitment, and the other one was communication. We don't communicate, of course. We don't trust another person with our feelings, so we don't share them. Or we think that they'll react this way. We make assumptions that are all false, probably, and so therefore we don't communicate. And I fell into that bracket where I wouldn't communicate things that I thought would offend him, you know what I mean? And so I wouldn't communicate back even when we were dating. And he said, I don't care if we marry. He says, I don't care if you scream at me, yell at me, what you want to go through, but you have to do it. Because his mother didn't do that. His mother was did not communicate, and he says, I need communication at all levels. I love the two big C's in his life. One was commitment, and I said, well, how am I different from them then? You love everybody just equally. And he says, no one else can make me cry. You're the only one that can make me cry. I've committed my life to you. I've committed my financial life to you. And he said, I went into many other commitments. And, and so where I, after he, I would sometimes not communicate. And that was probably my biggest hurdle. And he would say, that was kind of sad on my part, and one I had remorse for that I had not communicated. Because you can't do your part.
Arvilla, please enter the mic.
Okay.
We're starting to lose you.
Can you hear me? You can't even hear me, can you?
No, we heard you.
We heard you. A little murky.
Keep going, though.
But anyhow, that was it, basically. And I mean I valued the training period when you went over the after.
Yes.
The relationship we've been in are training things, you know what I mean? Because I've always beat up myself by saying, Arvilla, in your marriage vow, you said I do to commit yourself to one another, you know what I mean? And from all others. Well, I, of course, didn't commit myself to others, but I did not commit myself totally to him because I would not share things I thought might be offensive. I would remove myself at times from the relationship, which violates the relationship, because if you make a commitment to say, that I commit myself for each other and from all others, that for each other is critical, and that for each other is communication, I think, and trust.
Very good.
and trust go together for me. But
you know, Arvilla, you said something so important, and I think it is this, that we're all in training, and it's important to remember that.
You do not know how much you bless us. I couldn't live without Saturday.
Well, and what I pick up from what you're sharing, Arvilla, is, I mean, the two C's, commitment and communication, and how critically important both of those things are in a relationship. I really appreciate your emphasizing those things. And again, to me, those are things that we are just beginning to learn in this family setup that we have down here. And we will be continuing to understand the nature of commitment and the nature of communication between persons all the way up through the universe ascent, growing in our understanding of those things. So, yeah.
You know, something Arvilla said made me realize that in our vows we should be more realistic, and we should say things like, I promise to listen to you, and I promise to try and understand and give you my full attention, you know? And maybe vows should be more realistic and not so black and white, because we all are in training. We're learning how to get along. Mom and dad grow up just with the kid, just like the kids do in relationship, because so often, it's like my precious daughter said to me once, I know, Mom, your youngest is always the beneficiary of everything you learned from your oldest kid. I'm your oldest kid. You made all your mistakes on me. And there's so much truth to that, right? I was blown away by that insight, because and anybody who's ever been an oldest child understands they play a very important role in the family. And all the parental mistakes, the neuroses or whatever it is, often gets made on the oldest child. So and each person in a family has a role to play, and the children play a role as much as mom and dad do. And so we are all training, especially on this planet. We don't have the perfect ideal, pair to follow, to emulate, to say, look at them, look at Adam and Eve, aren't they beautiful, look at how they solved that problem, isn't that inspiring? I'm gonna do that. We don't have that, so we're definitely in training on this world. But
Paula, there's something you mentioned earlier that I'd like to highlight that kind of ties in with what Arvilla was saying, and it has to do with the Arantia book as a revelation and its portrayal of the relationship between Michael and the local universe Mother Spirit. This is like a whole new dimension of not just deity nature, but relationship potential, I think, that's so important, because it highlights the complemental difference, the value of complemental difference. So, Paul, earlier you were talking about, men don't, they're different, right?
They don't parent like women.
Yeah, right. So but the difference is complemental, is kind of, I think,
right,
what we can begin to realize. And there's a couple of paragraphs I just love to read here, because it kind of, in the absence of an Adam and Eve, even though this is, a written revelation, I think we can still take inspiration from it. And this is just a couple of paragraphs where they describe the relationship between Michael and the Mother Spirit. Since Michael achieved, after completing a seventh bestowal and achieving sovereignty, they say, this is the Jubilee of Jubilees, if you remember all that. Anyway,
yeah.
This is paper 33, section three, paragraph six. I might read some of seven too. Anyway, they say, after this pledge of subordination by the creative Mother Spirit, Michael of Nevadon nobly acknowledges his eternal dependence on his spirit companion, constituting the spirit co-ruler of his universe domains and requiring all the creatures to pledge themselves in loyalty to the spirit as they had to the sun. and there issued and went forth the final, quote, proclamation of equality. Though he was the sovereign of his local universe, the Son published to the world the fact of the Spirit's equality with him in all endowments of personality and attributes of divine character. And this becomes the transcendent pattern for the family organization and government of even the lowly creatures of the worlds of space. This is, indeed and in truth, the high ideal of the family and the family institution of voluntary marriage. The Son and Spirit now preside over the universe, much as a father and mother watch over and minister to their family of sons and daughters. It is not altogether out of place to refer to the universe spirit as the creative companion of the Creator Son and to regard the creatures of the realms as their sons and daughters. Grand and glorious family, but one of untold responsibilities and endless watch care. And then there's one more comment they make in the next paragraph. I won't read the whole thing, but just the last part, which totally reflects what Arvilla was just saying, where they mention that in the creation of universe personalities, both the Son and the Spirit function together. And in no creative act, does the one do aught without the counsel and approval of the other. So again, this is like a kind of setting a pattern. I refer to it as that.
But it's a complemental pattern.
I think is what's so important about it. It's not just a partnership of two beings who are the same. It's a partnership of two beings who are different, but complemental in their attributes. And if we learn to see men and women in that same light, in that falling into that same pattern, then all these difficulties and troubles that are, you know, gender relationships are difficult. You know, we all know that. But if we begin to see how there's value in that difference, then we can approach it with a different kind of, we have a different feeling in the heart about it.
Right.
Because of the potential that flows, the super additive possibilities.
Those were fabulous quotes, Chuck. Thank you for, and that is really embodies the ideal. And I hope we can go on and read section four here pretty quick, but I know you got both Marvin and Andre working with those quotes.
So. Yeah. Well, we got Marvin, and then Arvilla would like to weigh in one last thing, and then, yes, I agree with you. We should jump into the reading. Well, we're not exactly jumping in. We're sort of crawling into the reading today.
We're working on it.
We're fighting our way
toward the reading.
Clawing and scratching towards the reading.
Yes, clawing and scratching. Wading our way toward the reading. Mine will be pretty brief, and it's from later in paper 84, just building on what Chuck was saying about the difference. And it's something that came up in my practice and that I would sometimes share with couples as we worked on things. And the Orange Book makes a statement, 84.6.4, paper 84, section 6, paragraph 4. Women seem to have more intuition than men, but they also appear to be somewhat less logical. Now, a few things are interesting about that statement, apart from the fact that it might be a rather inflammatory statement in today's culture. But one of the things is they really qualify their statement. They say women seem to have more intuition and appear to be some. So they're not saying that women are more intuitive than men and are less logical. They're saying it looks that way. They seem to function that way. So that's interesting. But it's an interesting distinction. And one of the things that I would talk about with couples is my own experience that when struggling to come to a common understanding in a man and a woman in a relationship, oftentimes a woman, and I'm curious if you guys have this experience, oftentimes a woman has the experience of having a deep sense of what is right or true, but not necessarily being able to articulate very clearly why that's true. or justify it. And a man can often justify all over the place, but doesn't necessarily have a direct sense of what is good or right. And when they together, they bring those two capacities together, they together can accomplish a deep sense of what is true and a complete, a competent understanding of why it might be true.
And what
because they bring the intuition and the logic to bear on that situation. And
that's
I think these are generalizations, but it was always a pretty interesting conversation we would have with couples when we would talk about how they approach things differently. So anyways, that's one of the it's a good example of the complemental relationship that you were referring to, Chuck, I think.
And you know, also, not everybody is a great communicator. And it's not easy to communicate what you're feeling and what your emotion you're going through. And so the another critical talent or skill to, you know, nurture is creating a safe place where people feel safe to say what they're thinking and what they're feeling, you know, and not in danger for communicating something that may not be what the other person wants to hear. But there's, you know, just a general willingness to allow them to go ahead and stammer it out or get it out, as awkward as it may be. And I know from being married to a shy person for many, many, many years that it's not always easy to communicate. Everybody doesn't communicate easily, you know, especially those souls who are deep and internal. And it's difficult for them to express what they're feeling or what their emotions are. Not that they don't have them. It's just that it's difficult to express them. So I think,
well,
you know, creating a safe place for that to happen.
The danger in relationships is always the misunderstandings being perpetuated or enduring beneath the surface that aren't brought out and resolved.
Yeah, and resolved. Yeah. Exactly right.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying, Paula, you know, about your child, that when you come to the child and you say, look, you have feelings, you have a perspective. I may not understand what you're experiencing, but I will stand strong in support of the validity of what you're experiencing, even if I cannot understand it. And sooner or later, maybe sooner or later you can help me understand, and together we'll both be enriched, you know. And that's what happens. That's what happens in good families and couples and between parents and children, I think, because there's a profound respect for the validity of the experience of the other, even though one may not understand or might disagree with it.
Right. I agree.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Marvin.
Yeah.
That makes a healthy family. And communication is the key. Arvilla's right.
So Arvilla wanted to weigh in.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Arvilla, and then we should read. Or maybe I just throw up my hands and we don't bother to read today. I don't know.
No, let's read. Yeah, let's read. I just wanted to apologize. When you said bring your phone up closer, I brought my phone up closer.
Oh, no apology necessary, Arvilla. That's fine.
Did you have another
point you wanted to make?
No, I just wanted to apologize for that, but I also want to say that you were so right about we need the opposites, each other, because he needed me and I needed him in very strange ways that was expressed. But, the final thing I think I wanted to say was that we beat ourselves up because of that. So after he died, I had remorse that I had not been for him in ways that he was wanting me to be logically be in, but I would refuse to because of assumptions. I think we need to watch our assumptions, and we need to communicate because we assume it's that way that we don't really know. And like even on his deathbed, he was asking questions, and I thought, Arvilla, he's fine. You're not going to go into things that you wouldn't go in when you were, you know, living. And by gosh, you're not now. So I even had remorse over that.
definitely. Got to watch those assumptions.
I had common sense. So I think we beat ourselves up And that's the last thing I wanted to say, because we are our own worst enemies. And
so
we would never treat another person like we treat ourselves sometimes. And I just want to
thank
you that I'm in your beautiful family. Thank you for allowing me.
Aww. We love you, Bella. Thank you for being in our beautiful
family.
Glad to have
you here.
You're part of the beauty of it.
Chuck says, let's be.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Love you.
Love you, too.
So so what section are we actually at?
We're on four. Women's status in early society. And I'd be happy to read that, you guys.
Yeah,
please do.
That would be appropriate.
Okay.
So
this is
the woman,
paper.
As the woman in our company.
As the woman in status. Okay, so this is paper 84, Marriage and Family Life, Section 4, Woman's Status in Early Society. Generally speaking, during any age, women's status is a fair criterion of the evolutionary progress of marriage as a social institution, while the progress of marriage itself is a reasonably accurate gauge registering the advances of human civilization. Women's status has always been a social paradox. She has always been a shrewd manager of men. She has always capitalized man's stronger sex urge for her own interests and to her own advancement. By trading subtly upon her sex charms, she has often been able to exercise dominant power over man, even when held by him in abject slavery. Early woman was not to man a friend, sweetheart, lover, and partner, but rather a piece of property, a servant or slave, and, later on, an economic partner, plaything, and childbearer. Nonetheless, proper and satisfactory sex relations have always involved the element of choice and cooperation by woman, and this has always given intelligent women considerable influence over their immediate and personal standing, regardless of their social position as a sex. But man's distrust and suspicion were not helped by the fact that women were all along compelled to resort to shrewdness in the effort to alleviate their bondage. The sexes have had great difficulty in understanding each other. Man found it hard to understand woman, regarding her with a strange mixture of ignorant mistrust and fearful fascination, if not with suspicion and contempt. Many tribal and racial traditions relegate trouble to Eve, Pandora, or some other representative of womankind. These narratives were always distorted so as to make it appear that the women brought evil upon man. And all this indicates the one-time universal distrust of woman. Among the reasons cited in support of a celibate priesthood, the chief was the baseness of women. The fact that most supposed witches were women did not improve the olden reputation of the sex. Men have long regarded women as peculiar, even abnormal. They've even believed that women did not have souls, therefore were they denied names. During early times, there existed great fear of the first sex relation with a woman. Hence, it became the custom for a priest to have initial intercourse with a virgin. Even a woman's shadow was thought to be dangerous. Childbearing was once generally looked upon as rendering a woman dangerous and unclean. and many tribal mores decreed that a mother must undergo extensive purification ceremonies subsequent to the birth of a child. Except among those groups where the husband participated in the lying in, the expectant mother was shunned, left alone. The ancients even avoided having a child born in the house. Finally, the old women were permitted to attend the mother during labor, and this practice gave origin to the profession of midwifery. During labor, scores of foolish things were said and done in an effort to facilitate delivery. It was the custom to sprinkle the newborn with holy water to prevent ghost interference. Among the unmixed tribes, childbirth was comparatively easy, occupying only 2 or 3 hours. It is seldom so easy among the mixed races. If a woman died in childbirth, especially during the delivery of twins, she was believed to have been guilty of spirit adultery. Later on, the higher tribes looked upon death in childbirth as the will of heaven. Such mothers were regarded as having perished in a noble cause. The so-called modesty of women respecting their clothing and the exposure of the person grew out of the deadly fear of being observed at the time of a menstrual period. To be thus detected was a grievous sin, the violation of a taboo. Under the mores of olden times, every woman, from adolescence to the end of the childbearing period, was subjected to complete family and social quarantine, 1 full week each month. Everything she might touch, sit upon, or lie upon was, quote, defiled. It was for long the custom to brutally beat a girl after each monthly period in an effort to drive the evil spirit out of her body. But when a woman passed beyond the childbearing age, she was usually treated more considerately, being accorded more rights and privileges. In view of all this, it was not strange that women were looked down upon. Even the Greeks held the menstruating woman as one of the 3 great causes of defilement, the other 2 being pork and garlic. Okay, we're in good company. However foolish these olden notions were, they did some good since they gave overworked females, at least when young, 1 week each month for welcome rest and profitable meditation. Thus could they sharpen their wits for dealing with their male associates the rest of the time. This quarantine of women also protected men from over-sex indulgence, thereby indirectly contributing to the restriction of population and to the enhancement of self-control. A great advance was made when a man was denied the right to kill his wife at will. Likewise, it was a forward step when a woman could own the wedding gifts. Later, she gained the legal right to own, control, and even dispose of property, but she was long deprived of the right to hold office in either church or state. Woman has always been treated more or less as property, right up to and in the 20th century after Christ. She has not gained worldwide freedom from seclusion under man's control. Even among advanced peoples, man's attempt to protect woman has always been a tacit assertion of superiority. But primitive women did not pity themselves as their more recently liberated sisters are wont to do. They were, after all, fairly happy and contented. They did not dare to envision a better or different mode of existence. Oh, they said so much right there. Wow. You know, I got to say, as a woman who grew up, I was born in 1955, I grew up through all of these social changes and the sexual revolution and the summer of love and all of the things that happened in the 60s and 70s and 80s and on, and for women's rights and even children's rights. When I first read this, I thought, wow, this so puts in perspective the emotions that I have as a female becoming a woman, that the emotions that I had and have. And to be able to look at all of this so objectively and put it into perspective was so helpful to me. I can't tell you how helpful it was. It just made all the difference to understand. And this is not history. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but have you ever read this in any history book? And yet it makes so much sense. It just puts it all in context, the struggle in of women. And it just, you know, it helps. It's tremendously helpful, like so much in this revelation. It's just tremendously helpful to know and understand. Mm-hmm. And science, look at the role science has played. My gosh. I mean, to understand that, you know, I couldn't help thinking while reading this that, you know, throughout the monarchy, it was always a woman's fault if she didn't have a boy. You know, like she just magically had some kind of control over that. And, you know, some of the great misunderstandings they cover here in this section, that now that we have science, we understand fully what all those things are about. Menstruation, for instance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can understand how without science, some of these things seemed strange and made women a target. But now with science, our lives have improved tremendously in the understanding of the role we play. So, viva la science.
This really is
well, it takes our breath away, I think. It certainly takes mine away just to read this and recapitulate some of the history, you know, of humanity for sure, but of, you know, woman's evolution in society and what woman has had to go through. And it's just, honestly, I'm left more or less speechless every time I look at that. And in answer to your question, is some of that, has anybody ever read that before? Well, not likely, but when I was in college and was an early reader of the book and I was just looking for things, I stumbled upon William Graham Sumner's Folkways, and it was all in there. You know, that this kind of research had been done in the 19th century, you know, the late 19th century. And, you know, it's fascinating. It's known, and it was becoming more and more known. It still is known. But sociology has become less a science of society and something that is much softer in the sense of sometimes being imbued with ideology. And that's part of the problem with getting to the nub of some of these things. Nobody, you know, really wants to look at that any more than they want to look at the evolution of war or slavery as being something that was hard to... it's hard to imagine that we had to go through these things. But given primitive human beings, we did.
Yep.
I got to say, we're there now. I mean, I really, you know, these things that they describe, every single one of the things that they're describing in this section is going on now in different places
somewhere
on our
in
planet.
The world. Yep.
Yeah, this is this is not ancient history. I mean, one of the very strange aspects of our modern world is how dramatically spread out it is historically across the ages, from very primitive practices, you know, to the most modern and enlightened kinds of practices, where men and women really do attempt to live and work together in a co-equal fashion societally. There are large parts of our world, cultural places, where the most abysmal practices that they describe here are ongoing. Slavery and property, and severe abuse and trafficking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like we're in the middle of this struggle still. And when they say that, you know, a civilization is not judged as having emerged from barbarism until men and women can function equally in the world, we're still half our foot is in the barbarism stage, you know. So we're right now engaged, and you know, when you look at the work that the UN commissions on women's rights and equality are ongoing in many parts of the world, we're right in the middle of this. You know, we haven't emerged from it. We're lucky enough, maybe.
We could say we're emerging. Some cultures are emerging from it, but yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we've got to be realistic about that.
Yeah, we are lucky.
You know, it's a sad commentary on our society. And this is my view, and it's not based in any political kind of thing, but there are many, many rationales that you know, the United States of America had for pulling out of Afghanistan. There are many good reasons, and there was one very bad reason for not pulling out of Afghanistan that we didn't pay attention to. And the fact of the matter is, if the kinds of things that we knew were going to happen to women, if we believed for a minute that this would be happening only to men, I'm not sure that we would have gotten out. You know, I don't know. But the fact that it happens to women, you know, somehow it's more acceptable to go ahead and roll back freedom and to just, even though it was a foregone conclusion that we knew that, you know, and I'll leave that alone.
That would happen.
But to me, the idea that there are so many things that are so much more acceptable to allow to happen to women than they are to allow them to happen to men. And that, again, that fits the statement in the Arantia book that says that so long as one sex or another seeks to tyrannize over the other, you know, we haven't emerged from barbarism. Well, there we are, the barbaric planet Urantia. Give it a salute. Give a salute to barbarism.
Yeah.
There's a pattern here that I think is, and it never occurred to me until this reading that we were just doing today, that, you know, how with the universe mother spirit, they talk about how her personality emerges in stages. You know, first, you know, partnering with Michael in the early stages of creation. And then when they announced their intention to create life, there was this huge thing that happened. And then the Mother Spirit emerged a little more fully after that. And then finally, after the Jubilee of Jubilees, when this proclamation of equality took place, then her personality fully emerged. And they say that she's recognizable by all who attempt to contact her. And there's something interestingly similar in this evolutionary panorama that they're describing here, where this evolutionarily, this is leading up to a stage where men and women not being the same, but sharing equality of status and personality. And, you know, like they say with Michael and the Mother Spirit, you know, they have equality in terms of potential divinity of character and functional responsibility and importance and all those things. And that's, you know, when you have a true partnership relationship. But that emerges as a process of evolution. And all along the way, it's like the personality, you could almost say, of women in the larger sense is also emerging. I mean, with that, of course, in relation to God, maybe with in relation to other women, they're like totally on it. But having that recognized societally, where the personality of women, is recognized fully in its importance and equality, or, you know, with men. There's something similar there. I think it's kind of fascinating. And that provides, incentives to get these things worked out so that society can enjoy the full expression of the personality of women. And that's, you know, in a way similar to what happened with Michael and the Mother Spirit. And interestingly or ironically or whatever, that paralleled his emergence as in his sovereignty, but it required her cooperation to do that. You know, they even referred to her as his ever-present companion, you know, on the Mount of Transfiguration. They referred to her that way. So there's even a sense that she was his companion during his bestowal in some meaningful way. But this idea of the emergence of personality, which is a third source characteristic, at least in terms of the Mother Spirit, you know, being a third source personality, she's in this whole other category of personality type. And we can see a little bit of that reflected, I think, in this evolutionary struggle that they're describing here. And it's a combination of the men, you know, wanting that and allowing that at the same time as the women seizing the opportunity for that, and that's recognized and honored by all parties, you know, as an evolutionary goal.
Right.
And that's, yeah. So anyway, I just think that's kind of an interesting parallel, this emergence that they're talking about, like in the first paragraph of the section we just read, you know, where the woman's status is a fair criterion of evolutionary progress. So women's status, that also is pointing to her, the recognition of the personality expression of women in the world, just in the way that the Mother Spirit's, her expression of personality in the universe also evolved and emerged over time. Anyway, just a thought. I've never thought about that before, but I think there's a parallel there somewhere.
The parallel of the divine counselor's emergence, the Mother Spirit's emergence, and women's emergence as well, that it's the pattern is that we... I wonder if this happens on all worlds, you guys. I'll throw that out there. On worlds where there's an Adam and Eve, I don't think this happens. I don't think women are put at such a disadvantage as this. You know, but what do you think?
I think it's universal. I think it happens in all worlds, and it's part of the emergence out of barbarism.
Okay.
What I think is different where there's an intact Adamic regime is it probably happens earlier and much more effectively in history than it has happened on our world. But like my guess is, on a normal world, we wouldn't have these large pockets of primitive culture where women are still dealt with as property, as we do on this world. It would be much more homogenous and widespread as an ideal. But I think it's still an ideal that has to be struggled for and accomplished by evolutionarily with the help of the Atomic Mission, I think.
Right, of course. They would help us overcome that, and that would be a big help. But we still have to struggle with it.
The animal nature and the animal vestiges that are in men and women are there on every evolutionary world.
Yeah. Well, and it made the comment that women were able to use the sex urge to their advantage. Of course, we see that, and that required because it required their cooperation. But it also seems true that the stronger tends to want to force the weaker, always. And the resentment when all of a sudden the weaker asserts itself and says, oh, no, you don't. You're not going to force me.
Well, you know, this is really...
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Paula. Well, go ahead.
Well, this seems to be the crux of, you know, so many dynamics at play on this planet when the minority or the weaker party asserts itself and says, no more. We're not going to do this no more. And so there's a backlash, obviously, and various things ensue. And perhaps a lot of the divorce rates we're seeing through these tumultuous years of the 20th century and now in the 21st century are a result of that backlash, a woman asserting herself, saying, no, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to change the rules of the game a bit here. And so that backlash is, you know, felt on all levels, especially in marriages, and a lot of confusion results. And, you know, and then you have these, as Chuck pointed out, these societies, or I can't remember who said it, but, you know, obviously there's still serious barbarism going on this planet, and women are still seriously mistreated in places. Andre pointed out in Afghanistan, what's so sad about that is for 20 years they didn't have to deal with that, and now all of a sudden they're thrust backwards into this other scenario that must be like a living a nightmare for them, you know. So but it does take, I think, of Jesus telling the man in Tarentum, you know, that was abusing his wife, man has no rightful authority over woman except that she willingly gives him that authority. And women don't own that power. And part of the reason is because we have children. And because we're so responsible for them, that puts us at a much greater disadvantage. Because if he kills me, who's going to take care of my children? And so we swallow a lot of injustice just for the ability to be able to be the one that raises our children because we love them so much. You know, so that puts us at a great disadvantage, I think. But anyway, I kind of went off down a rabbit trail there. I'm sorry. What were you going to say, Maureen?
Add a little thought to that.
Very valid.
Yeah. Just one quick thing, Maureen. Well, it just occurred to me. Well, never mind. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Such a great conversation.
And then I'll add mine. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to throw in the thought that one of the things we observe in the world is one of the strategies, if you want to call it that, for women to escape from, you know, this kind of bondage they're talking about socially and culturally and even economically, is the sense that women have to become like men.
Yeah.
So, and even dress like men, you know, wearing suits and trying to take on the attitudes and characteristics of men in order to succeed, let's say, in the corporate world or something like that. And
right. In
a way, I think that's unfortunate because it kind of neutralizes the creative dynamic of difference. So if there's, what I'm hoping for is an emerging recognition and honoring of the difference so that even in social roles in the world, roles of responsibility, the women could be womanly, you know what I mean, and the men can be manly. They don't have to become the same in order to share responsibility. I think, don't they say, talking about a neighboring planet, somewhere in the book, they talk about how a man and a woman working together will, like, hold office, in a sense, because of the recognized value in combining the difference in perspectives, not because they're being made to be the same. So our kind of first instinct is, oh, let's make men and women the same. That'll solve the problem, right? But it doesn't, in a way.
It makes it worse.
Anyway, that's all I wanted to say about that.
Sort of related to that, I want to bring in a couple of things. I think I'll bring in this thing first. It's from the section we just read, 84.4.3, the third paragraph in this section, 84.4. And they make this very interesting statement. It's the second sentence in the paragraph. Nonetheless, proper and satisfactory sex relations have always involved the element of choice and cooperation by woman. And this has always given intelligent women considerable influence over their immediate and personal standing, regardless of their social position as a sex. So what I want to focus on is, and it's what you're also driving at here, Chuck, as well, with a complemental balance. In Jungian psychology, there's this concept of the animus and the anima. And what the Jungians will say is that a mature and fully balanced human being is a male who is in touch with his anima and a female who is in touch with her animus. In other words, the men are ideally should be in touch with the minority part of themselves that have a feminine element, and women should be in touch with a minority part of themselves that have a masculine element. And in ideal mature functioning, we function androgynously, which means I as a male function with the female, the feminine part of me integrated and incorporated into the way I behave and act and think and feel, and a woman incorporates and has blended the male elements in her functioning as well. And in mature family functioning, and this is what this is getting to, the male has to go ahead and acknowledge the equality of the female, and they together can accomplish something in mature personal life and in mature family life that cannot be accomplished any other way. And this is the key thing. A man can dominate a woman, but will never have satisfying sexual relations or satisfying family relations unless the man doesn't do that and it does the opposite, but acknowledges the feminine in himself, acknowledges the equality of his partner, and they together discover something in family life and personally that can only be discovered through cooperative relationship. That's the key. Which is the ideal of spiritual family love, where you do unto another the way you would have be done unto yourself, right? It's the golden rule played out in family life and in relations between men and women. So the overall conclusion is really mature functioning as an individual and in family can only happen when all parties are searching for and finding the spiritual ideal to live by. So it's sort of a culmination of things on many levels, I think. Anyway, so those are just, the whole Jungian idea of honoring and integrating the opposite nature in ourselves is, I think, really quite profound.
Well, and we all have a mother and a father. And really, the happiest children are the most balanced human beings are ones who had influence from both. And, you know, my father had a tremendous influence on me. And I recall the words he said and his wisdom often. I feel my father in me, you know. I feel that my father. Remember back in the, 70s where they did the whole thing about you were either your parent, your child, or yourself, I guess. And different aspects of your personality would come out. And that's, you're like, oh, yeah, that's my parent. You know, I get that. And we both have, or we all have a mother and a father, both. And both those individuals had some kind of influence over our lives. And so, and it, we definitely all have a masculine and a feminine nature. But I think, so the key is what, you know, and I love your point, Marvin, what is it that a woman brings that's unique and special? And what is it that a man brings that's unique and special? And how do they complement each other? And how do they make each one better than they are without the other? You know, when they come together, they become more than they either one alone is.
And the only way to discover that, for a man to get that from a woman, for a woman to get that from a man, is through a mutual and respectful cooperative engagement,
right,
which is what happens in a really
and
good
volitional
family.
It has
exactly
to be volitional.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, wholehearted,
so it's like
volitional.
There's this sort of really intriguing arrangement where the only way we each get to have what we can potentially have is through cooperative and respectful relationship. Anything less than that leaves us shortchanged, which is really intriguing that it's set up that way, you know?
Yeah, and I think one of the principles that applies in the dynamic of discovering that or realizing that or making that happen is an attitude reaching across this gulf of difference, right, that is more curious than judgmental. I mean, somebody said something I thought about a lot, that when you regard something you don't understand or a person you don't understand or their behavior baffles you or whatever, it's always important to be more curious than to immediately judge the other person according to what you're assuming. You know, it's like Arvilla was bringing up about having assumptions about the other person that may be totally incorrect unless you find out. You know, in the book they say you can't really love someone until you know them. And to know them, you have to know their motivations. You have to know what they care about. Why? What's motivating them? Why are they making these decisions? The only way to find that out is to be curious and open, rather than just immediately judging and rejecting, which, especially if
what you don't understand
behavior feels threatening in some way.
You have to be willing to let go.
Even more important to have that, hold that principle in mind, I think.
Right. What did you say, Marvin?
You have to be willing to let go of your preconceptions and hold them loosely, you know, and say, hey, you know, be humble, you know, and say, I don't know it all. There's so much more I need to discover. So what can you teach me? What can we mutually benefit by if we hold our assumptions loosely? And you know, it's the old frames of reference lesson from the book. It's like all of our frames of reference are due to be outlived, you know, so we have to hold them loosely all the time, really.
Mm-hmm. Going back to Arvilla's point, you make assumptions.
Right.
And you really have to look at your assumptions and ask yourself sincerely, are these correct? And maybe even ask your spouse or your partner, okay, here's my assumption. Am I correct? You know.
It's the funny thing about the word assume. You guys have heard it, I'm sure, you know. The word assume makes an ass out of you and me.
I think about that one a lot, Marvin.
Yeah.
Especially if I'm tempted to make an assumption.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Well, if you think about how it feels when another person is curious about you.
Yeah.
How that feels compared to just hitting a stone wall of judgmental opinions. It's just it's completely when someone else expresses curiosity about you, you feel loved. I mean, I think there's a connection, at least in a relationship sense, between curiosity and love.
And it's literally
the judgmental attitude is almost the opposite. It's like closing the other person off. You know, I'm mad at you about something or whatever, you know.
Or you're not worthy.
Judgment's in prison and curiosity liberates,
That's beautiful, And that's what that was the point I was making. When in communication, you have to create a space, a safe space for that to happen. And that comes from experience, my own experience with being married to someone who, if I said the wrong thing, would turn the table upside down on me or start throwing
things at me.
That's a good example. You know? Not
being very curious.
Not only am I not curious about what you think, I don't want to hear you. I don't want to hear what you think.
Well, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
It's dangerous.
Yeah,
for
it's
me
dangerous
to be myself. Yeah, yeah.
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 Right. Mm. So.
Very interesting conversation.
Yep.
Yeah.
Perry on the boards. I just want to share what Perry was saying. She first said wondering if the weight of the many years of pre-planetary prince human evolution had some bearing on the imbalance of the roles of the sexes. And then she went on to say, so many eons of hurt and misunderstanding get in the way of curious, open attitudes. We get triggered. Boy, isn't it? And that's what obviously would cause my first husband to turn the table upside down on me and start throwing things. He got triggered by something I said. And,
well, it's interesting to bring up the planetary prince, because not only Adam and Eve, but a fully functioning, you know, Dalmatia center of culture in the world would have included the corporeal staff, which were men and women working together as couples.
Mm-hmm.
Good
and
point.
We would have had that also.
Yeah, good
to,
point.
And to see and watch.
Yeah.
And with this whole variety of
To observe how effective
you're responding to. Yeah, you're responding to Paula's earlier point. And I posted it on the chat board. You know, you were talking about, you know, male and female domination. And it's very interesting because sex equality isn't achieved during the Adamic dispensation. It's achieved before the Adamic dispensation on a normal planet. In paper 52, section 2, paragraph 7, it says, this is the dispensation of the realization of sex equality. On some planets, the male may rule the female. On others, the reverse prevails. Now, it's going to be interesting to view some of those planets and see how evolution put, you know, women at the head of the game and dominating men. You know, so it isn't endemic to men that this should happen.
Right.
During this age, normal worlds establish full equality of the sexes, that being the post-planetary prince age, this being preliminary to the fuller realization of the ideals of home life. This is the dawn of the golden age of the home. The idea of tribal rule gradually gives way to the dual concept of national life and family life.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting. The dual concept of national life and family life.
Right.
Huh.
So I can really imagine, you know, how evolution occurs on a particular planet and from what kind of species, you know, what kind of primate species or perhaps other species. We don't know that for sure, but you can wonder, you know, what might lead to the ascendancy of women on some planets. And but it doesn't, on a normal world, it doesn't obtain past the planetary prince age. Isn't that interesting? So we can blame not Adam and Eve's default,
good
but we can blame
point.
The rebellion.
And yeah. And it goes to Chuck's point that we would have observed these couples working together in true partnership from there, from then, the corporeal staff. And they would have guided that.
Well, what's interesting is, I'm really glad you pointed that out, Audrey, because I would have assumed that this equality would have been a result of the Adamic mission.
Me
but
too.
You're saying it actually, that's really interesting. And what it says to me is, you know, on our planet, we had this 500,000-year period of time, which is a huge amount of time. And the default occurred, about 250,000 to 300,000 years into it. And what a critical, and from that point on, the mission of the planetary prince dramatically deteriorated. And what would normally have happened is in that last 200,000 years, is the things you were describing, you know, the stabilization of male-female roles and their ideal and the establishment of good nations and good family life. And instead, when Adam and Eve arrived, it was nothing but tribal barbarism. It was a horrendous situation they were faced with. Yeah. So
And that's
so
to Perry's point, really.
Yeah,
she was speculating what really, you know, does this go all the way back? And yeah, Perry, I guess you're right, it does. And we get triggered from a very deep place, unconsciously. And here we are, you know, working through all of these issues in the last 100 years, maybe a little more. But, I mean, it's been ongoing, but imagine the progress we've made in this regard in 100 years. It's
You know, this is sort of a tangential point, but it's really almost shocking that as a result of the Planetary Prince regime, there would have been fully functioning nations 40,000-50,000 years ago all around our world.
Yeah.
Wow.
And instead, we really haven't had nations really fully develop until the last 3,000 years, really. Until
they're still
then,
not fully developed.
Still not fully developed. So
no.
It's like,
we even call it that. They're developing.
What a different world we would be in had that default not occurred. So, boy, it really strikes you. What a different path
it does.
Our world has taken. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting in the context of the gender dominance, you know, thoughts. Sally posted on the board, I bet those planets are more peaceful and, you know, the female-dominated planets. And Paula responded, ha-ha, I wonder. So my question is, what do you guys think? And what do you think, Paula?
I have seen, I'll open it up, I've seen women be very mean to men, and it hurts my heart.
And to women.
Because, and I've seen women be very mean to other women, even brutal and cruel, terribly cruel. And so it's in them that the animal, you know, certainly the fact that we bear life and bring it into the world conditions us to really respect life and want to nurture life. And that's more of a natural feminine instinct to be kind and ministerial to anyone who's in distress and in trouble. There's a minister. When women get together, you know, like when we go on retreat, we're so kind to each other and we just unabashedly minister to each other and we don't feel silly about it or funny about it, and we openly accept it from each other, and it's really wonderful. And I've noticed this especially among spiritual women, but I've also seen in the world, you know, a cruelty in women that, you know, is also astonishing to me. And you know, so I think, I don't know if that's true, with all respect, Sally. I don't know if it's true that a female-dominated world would be kinder and more loving and more peaceful. I think just like a male-dominated world, they'd have to get over their domination and learn to love, willingly and openly love and respect their counterparts. And
you know,
then, you know, the evolution would happen, but...
I agree with you, Paul. The phrase, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, which is a really interesting principle. What it says to me is that women, having been for so long relatively powerless in our society, has taught them tremendous compassion and really spiritually helped in their development. And men have been grasping and selfish because they've been in power, and that had the situation been reversed, it might actually be the opposite. Men might be the more compassionate sex if they had to struggle the way women have struggled.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think that men and women working together peacefully, I think, is what will create a peaceful world. Not one or the other dominating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's our goal, I think, evolutionarily, is to achieve that. And that'll upstep all of our institutions, all of our cultural practices, you know, everything, into a more peaceful...
Well, every once in a while... Yeah, sorry. Didn't mean to cut you off there, Chuck. I just wanted to say parenthetically, every once in a while I announce that I'd like to do a tour in the next life, and one of the planets I'd like to go to is one of the ones that went into rebellion, you know, with its planetary prince, that was a female-dominated planet. And there's probably more than one, because it sounds like this could go either way. When they mm-hmm. say on some planets, the male may rule the female. They don't say mostly. On others, the reverse mm-hmm. prevails. That's either 50-50, or they're saying dominance happens, and in some cases, maybe dominance doesn't happen. But at least it happens equally, it seems, is what this
yeah.
this seems to be. Maybe slightly more prevalent with the males, who knows. But, yeah, it's an interesting. But I'm taking hands. We'll get our seraphim to get us over to one of these worlds, and we'll take a tour and maybe learn something about the evolution of a female-dominated culture in the post-planetary prince age, huh?
Yeah, you know, how are we going to, I think that one thing women can do, and this is something that I thank my brothers, you know, because they made life tough for me. And it wasn't okay to be a little girl in my family. It wasn't okay to be feminine. And they made that known. And that's challenging. That's still challenging for me. But what they taught me was to stand up for myself. And what I have found in my life is that, you know, I mentioned respect earlier. And I think for men, especially, respect is a large part of love. And women who are too submissive, women who just give in and cave in and never exert their own needs or their own opinion or never stand up for themselves, they lose men's respect. And when that happens, then, you know, it can be dreadful. It's horrid. And sometimes it's very hard for women to stand up, obviously, because they're at a disadvantage, as we've said. But it's vitally important for them to do it. It's vitally important for women to stand up for themselves. And it goes back to even Jesus. Man has no rightful authority over woman except that she willingly gives him that. She needs to take her own authority. And she needs to stand up for herself, perhaps more strongly on this world than any other world. Because the fact that she doesn't only creates a worse problem, I think. And if I could give young women anything, it would be that. Stand up for yourself. Don't be a doormat. Stand up for yourself. If you stand up for yourself, he'll respect you more. And if he respects you more, then you'll have a much better shot at having that equal relationship and that respect that you crave.
I think it's also, you know, from a spiritual point of view, it is a service to the man if a woman will assert herself and be forthright and assertive. Because what happens for a man is when a man is unchallenged in that way, then the man can easily slip into spiritual lethargy and deteriorate and become dominant, become crass,
abusive,
et cetera.
Even. Yeah.
Yeah. When women assert themselves, men are called to the better part of their nature and have to respond with spiritual search and spiritual depth, and then they together can accomplish things that neither one can accomplish alone. So, it, not only is it critical for the health of a woman, I think it's critical for the health of a man that a woman be self-respecting and properly assertive. We're not talking about being angry and attacking. We're talking
about
being self-respectful, you know?
Right.
And
thoughtful.
So I
in her language, in her...
Line. Yeah.
You know, a lot of times women resort to being abusive themselves with their language toward men, and that's not helpful either. You know,
mm-hmm.
you have to be reasonable and logical and clear, and assertive is a good word. You know, just, okay, I understand that's your point of view, but here's my point of view. And this is a uniquely, woman's perspective. And obviously, you know, it's based on marrying somebody who's reasonable and willing to hear you out. But still, you still have to be able to communicate. Right.
Let's see how we can blend our perspectives. Neither of us could have achieved alone.
Right.
Yeah. And it points to what Jesus was trying to say. He would stop at nothing to restore a true self-respect, you know, to each human being.
To those who had lost it.
Yeah, man and woman. Yeah. And it's only when people really have relations based on mutual respect and true self-respect that they can be healthy and both people can really mature spiritually. You know, so, and that's what happens in good families. You know?
Yeah, and that respect is earned. I think that's another important thing. It's not just, hey, you respect me, and I don't have to earn your respect. You know, no, you can have an attitude of respectfulness, but really, mutual respect is earned, and both partners have to earn it from the other. It's not just given, you know. No matter what. It's like Stephen Covey used to say, you know, you can't just keep withdrawing that on that bank account and when not putting anything back in, you know.
And part of that, I think, is this idea of having a project that you're both working on, you know, this third entity. Some people sometimes, it's sort of like the conjoint actors, right? So in a marriage, you know, there's the family or the relationship itself even. Is an entity kind of in and of itself, and to honor that and be involved and curious about where that's going, then it's like two people working on the same thing. They can both derive self-respect from the accomplishment of that conjoint enterprise, and that's I think a really important dimension of that potential for self-respect. It's not just about me, or it's not just about the other person, it's about what we're doing together. And if that succeeds, then we can both derive a lot of self-respect from that accomplishment. And then you both have an investment in it. So the self-respect flows naturally from the mutual dependence on the, you know, succeeding in this creative endeavor.
Yeah, it's a common life project, you know, that's a team.
Yeah.
It's almost like you get into a contractual understanding that is quite profound spiritually. It's not a superficial thing that says we will work together to create and nurture life, you know, and this will be, it's sort of like a major life project, you know. And if it's done well, it's done right, then I think the partnership actually survives and thrives even post, you know, even after you're done with a project proper. You know, the partnership survives. But I think that's one of the reasons they say that the marriage and family institution doesn't survive into the mansion worlds and beyond, is because there isn't that main project that the two partners are engaged in. That's been completed. And so they're liberated, in a sense, to function again as individuals. But they've learned tremendous lessons of cooperation and partnership, you know. That I don't think get learned any other way. So
yeah. Good point. Well, what a great conversation, you guys. Thank you so much. I mean, this, how can you go wrong with this paper? You just can't. Don't you just wish every young couple could read these marriage papers before they engage? And maybe that's what they had in mind. Here's your course of study, kids.
Yeah, Andre was talking last week about a, you know, training for family life. You know, amen to that. Well, what an idea.
Yep.
Indeed.
What an idea. You know, I put up a quote on the board earlier, and it's just, and we didn't read, you know, we didn't do paper 83, the marriage institution, or paper 82, the evolution of marriage. Those are all so important. But this quote from paper 83, this is from 83.76, it says, "The real test of marriage all down through the ages has been that continuous intimacy, which is inescapable in all family life. Two pampered and spoiled youths, educated to expect every indulgence and full gratification of vanity and ego, can hardly hope to make a great success of marriage and home building. a lifelong partnership of self-effacement, compromise, devotion, and unselfish dedication to child culture. It kind of says it all, doesn't it?
Can you imagine, Paula, what if, like Andre has suggested, we would have a course, you know, that educated young men and women who are contemplating marriage. This is what you're getting yourselves into here, guys. So,
<Yeah.
laughs> you know, really, really get your arms around this. This is really what this next 40 years is going to be about, right? So, you know, you better understand it and really value this kind of enterprise, because this is what you're getting into.
This is what you're getting into. Well, you know what? We're out of time, and what a great conversation. Thank you, guys. And we'll be back next week. Thanks, listeners. Thanks to everyone on the board. We had a great crew on the board today. We had all women and one man, which is great.
Yeah.
Robert showed up, but we had like six women and one man on there. It was fun to see the comments, too. We'll be back next week with the next section, Section 5, which is, again, about women. It's women under the developing mores. So we hope you'll tune in with us, and we'll be back. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
All right.
What a fun study.
Good to be with you all.
Yep.
Huh? Have
Good
a
time.
Great week.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
bye for now.
I love it, by the way. I love it that this program is helmed by a woman. Paula, you do a wonderful job.
Oh, thanks, Marvin. It's
yes.
Such a pleasure and honor to study with you guys.
All right.
So, yay.
Well, love you all.
Love you, too.
Week. Yep.
Take care.
Yep.
Happy MLK Day. Yeah,
you
go
bet.
With God. Yay.
Bye-bye.
I know.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.